and one day, not too long from now, he would ride a horse. Although he'd had a couple hours' sleep in the back seat of the Rover the night before, he needed a nap, but he didn't think it was a good idea to sleep. So he ate another power bar to help himself stay awake, and he gave each of the dogs a biscuit. That used up 5 minutes. 2 hours was a long time, but not if he kept busy. There was a lot that needed to be done. The house was full of dust and cobwebs, and there were dead pill bugs in some corners. He took a roll of paper towels and a spray bottle of Windex to the bathroom. They had used the Windex in the kitchen. He climbed onto the counter beside the sink. He used the Windex and the paper towels to clean the mirror above the counter. If you wanted to do something right, which was the only way you should do anything, there was a trick to it. His mom had taught him the trick. The trick was to care about doing a good job and not do it fast just to be done with it. Queenie kept coming to the bathroom door to look at him. She wouldn't come into the bathroom because the Windex made her sneeze. Duke was going room to room on patrol. Sometimes he passed the bathroom door, grumbling to himself. Travis was working on the really dirty sink, trying not to think about who might have spit in it and what they might have spit, when a telephone rang somewhere else in the house. Aunt Jessie and Uncle Gavin had said not to answer the door and stay away from the windows, but they didn't say what to do if the phone rang. He left the bathroom, Duke at his side, Queenie behind him. He followed the sound and found the phone in the kitchen. It was on the counter, next to the fridge. It looked like the special phone his mom called on. She didn't call often, only to say she was coming for a visit. And she always called at night when he was in bed, so he'd never heard the phone ring. But he was pretty sure this was the phone. He never talked on this phone with his mom. It wasn't for long conversations. It was for quick messages and emergencies. If it was his mom, he wanted to talk to her. If it wasn't his mom, if it was one of the bad people, then if he answered, maybe they would know where to find him. The dogs stood one to each side of Travis, and all three of them stared at the phone. The dogs' ears were pricked forward, their bodies tense. They weren't wagging their tails. The dogs didn't seem to like the phone. Travis decided to answer it anyway. Just take the call and not say anything unless he heard his mom's voice. But as he reached for it, the phone stopped ringing. 30. The town of Borrego Springs is as far removed from Carter Jurgens' experience as any place on the moon. If he believed in hell, he would call this a preview of that satanic kingdom. The temperature report in the Velociraptor dashboard readout claims it is 88 degrees, but as he and Dubose walk the downtown, such as it is, the day feels hotter than that. In summer, it probably hits 120 degrees most days. The air is so dry, he repeatedly licks his lips to keep them from cracking, and his sinuses seem to be shriveling inside his skull. In Borrego Springs, wherever there are not vast expanses of concrete and blacktop, there are even bigger expanses of bare, sandy earth. On three sides, mountains rise in the distance, and on the fourth side, they loom closer, barren crags of rock as forbidding as the cliffs where Zeus chained Prometheus and sent an eagle to tear out his liver every day for the crime of giving fire to humanity. Desert surrounds the town and intrudes everywhere, spotted with withered scrub, no doubt abounding with rattlesnakes, poisonous lizards, and tarantulas the size of basketballs. The strip shopping centers and the standalone businesses are landscaped with pebbles, cactuses, and curious arrangements of rocks that seem intended to convey some mystical message. Clusters of dusty trees are planted close to the sides of houses to shade them. In the business district, however, there are little more than widely separated palms rising from small cutouts in blacktop and concrete, casting meager patches of shade. They look pathetic, desperate, as though they long to be dug up, root boxed and hauled on a truck to Florida. Sun glares off bare earth, pavement, buildings, and windows, which store the heat and radiate it back. The entire town is like one giant pizza oven. The only grass seems to be in the heart of Borrego Springs, in what is called Christmas Circle, a park with a comparative wealth of trees, mostly palms and evergreens, encompassed by a roundabout from which seven streets radius off like spokes from the hub of a wheel. Jurgen feels displaced, foreign, shipwrecked on a strange shore. A pizza and beer restaurant, taco shop, Mexican grill and bar, coffee shop, liquor store. He sees no evidence of a French or northern Italian restaurant, or any place with refined Mediterranean cuisine. Not even sushi. He suspects that every eatery in town will accept a customer in t-shirt, shorts, and sandals. Looking through an art gallery window, he does not see one item that fits any definition of art known to him. Everywhere are pickups, jeeps, and SUVs. Although summer is months away, everyone has a tan, as if they've never heard of melanoma, and they're weirdly sociable. Most people whom they pass on foot, total strangers, speak to them. "Beautiful day," and "good afternoon," and "have a nice day," which is the most alien thing about the place, though not to DeBose, who smiles and returns the greetings. "Why are you talking to strangers like you know them?" Carter finally asks. "We shouldn't be calling attention to ourselves."
"You're calling attention to yourself by not speaking when spoken to."
"They're strangers.
What do I care if they think it's a nice day or want me to have one? What's wrong with them anyway? Why are they so concerned I shouldn't have a crappy day?"
"Just relax, Carter Northrop Jurgen III, and look for something out of the ordinary."
"Everything here is out of the ordinary, and I'm the fourth, not the third."
"That explains a lot."
"What do you mean by that?"
"The quality of any gene pool," DeBose said, "is adversely affected by the number of generations in which, unfortunately, few new bloodlines have been introduced."
Jurgen considers commenting to the effect that the Northrop and Jurgen families do not, unlike some, have numerous pairs of married cousins in the family tree, but he's too hot and too afflicted with desert-inspired ennui to get into a tit-for-tat. 31. The stress of leaving their comfortable life behind, the chase in the desert, and a night without sleep left Gavin with bloodshot eyes, a stiff neck, various sore muscles, and a general fatigue against which he had to struggle to remain alert. For breakfast, they'd eaten power bars, nothing for lunch. Now, every edible item that Jesse added to the shopping cart made his stomach growl. A month's supplies for three people and two dogs would require two grocery carts piled high with goods, which meant both Gavin and Jesse would be too preoccupied to be constantly, adequately on guard. The solution was to split the task between the town's two main markets, buying only canned and packaged goods in the first, more canned goods and all the perishables in the second, a single piled high cart per store. In the first market, Jesse pushed the cart, and Gavin tagged along, commenting on the prices and pretending to quibble about brand choices, trying not to be obvious when he scoped out the other shoppers to make sure nobody seemed to be taking an unusual interest in them. He didn't think their photographs were on TV. The Arcadians wouldn't want the media to know that those sheltering Jane Hawk's son had been identified. The bastards never intended to rescue the boy. They meant to capture him. If the authorities made an official announcement, they would thereafter have to operate by the book and place Travis with child welfare services, whereupon Jane's in-laws, Claire and Ansel Hawk in Texas, would seek custody. Considering that he was a cute 5-year-old who'd recently lost his father and whose mother was the most wanted fugitive in America, the human interest factor would ensure a media frenzy.
Any judge who ruled against the grandparents would be a villain in the public's eye, create sympathy for Jane, and raise the suspicion that there might be more to her story than the carefully crafted image of a beautiful monster who had sold her country's most important, if unspecified, secrets to an enemy power, killing numerous people along the way. So the grandparents would be given custody, and sooner rather than later, to regain control of the boy, corrupt authorities would inject Claire and Ansel with brain implants, the worst of all possible outcomes for Jane. No, the bad guys would not risk losing control of the media narrative. They would keep the hunt for Gavin and Jesse out of the news. Everything went smoothly in the first market. In the parking lot, they transferred their purchases from the cart to the trunk of the Honda. They drove a short distance to the second establishment. 32. As they are strolling around a little shopping complex, Jurgen suddenly feels revitalized when he does indeed see something out of the ordinary. About 50 feet ahead of them, a black couple in their 30s crosses the parking lot and approaches the entrance to a market. Jurgen can't clearly see the man's face, but his height and body type are right for Gavin Washington. The guy is bald, but maybe he shaved his head. The woman appears to be black, which Jessica Washington isn't. She could be wearing a wig. What's out of the ordinary about them is the same thing that makes Jurgen and DuBose different from everyone else they've seen in Borrego Springs. On this hot afternoon, both the man and woman are wearing sport coats, and the coats are cut roomy enough to conceal weapons. As the two disappear into the market, DuBose says,
"But she has her own legs."
"She's wearing full-length khakis. How do you know what's under them?"
"She's walking like people with real legs walk."
"Because she's got Autobox."
"She's got what?"
"She uses Blade Runner legs when she's in races. Other times, she uses Autobox X3s. Jurgen spells O-T-T-O-B-O-C-K.
"Evidently, you didn't read everything in the background report on the bitch."
DuBose is unrepentant.
"Background reports are written by desk-bound pussies who believe they're gonna write a novel one day and win a Pulitzer. I skim their flowery shit."
Avoiding the flowery shit, Jurgen says, "Here's the essence. Each prosthetic knee has multiple sensors, a gyroscope, terrific hydraulics, a microprocessor, software, a resistance system, and a battery. She can run reasonably well, walk backward, climb steps, and look natural doing it."
"So you think that's them?"
"What do you think?" Jurgen asks. DuBose frowns.
"I think we should have a closer look."
33. Jesse kept checking her wristwatch, thinking about Travis at the house with just the dogs and the pepper spray. She didn't worry that the people hunting for him would find him, but there was always the possibility of a fire, or an earthquake, or he might cut himself somehow on something and be bleeding badly. Her fears arose less from likely threats to the boy than from weariness and from distress at how abruptly their lives had been turned upside down. She'd had no sleep the previous night, and the responsibility she felt for the boy stropped her nerves, until her anxiety was sharper than it had been since the war. During their time in the first market, she hadn't trusted her ability both to appear relaxed and to react quickly if a threat materialized. Her mind was fuzzy. Her reflexes weren't what they should be. There was a real possibility that if she had to go for her gun, she might fumble with the sport coat. Consequently, during the drive between markets, she had taken the Colt Pony 380 from the low-ride belt-fixed rig on her hip and put it in her purse. The purse was now propped in the small fold-down basket that overhung the larger part of the grocery cart. The zipper was open, the pistol grip awaiting her hand, tucked between her wallet and a packet of Kleenex. Even with the weapon better positioned for a quick draw, and though everything had gone smoothly thus far, Jesse worried about Travis.
They had hardly begun their tour through the second market, but already they'd been away 90 minutes. They wouldn't get back to the house for at least another hour, which would be half an hour later than they had promised. 34. Immediately after spotting the suspects, Jürgen and Dubose hurry to the back of the market, where deliveries are made. The door is unlocked. They step inside and stand blinking in the cool air as their eyes adjust to the low light. This is the warehousing space behind the sales floor, and it is smaller than Jürgen expected. You can't call the market a mom-and-pop operation, but neither does it deserve the prefix super. Here are three men in black slacks and white shirts, two of them wearing white aprons with the market logo on the breast. The one without an apron is cutting away the shrink wrap from three pallets of recently delivered goods. The other two are transferring 5-pound bags of sugar from one of the pallets to metal storage shelves. The guy scissoring the shrink wrap straightens up from his work. He has close-cropped hair, a scrubbed look, no face jewelry, no visible tattoos, neatly pressed pants, and shoes with a high shine. His just-so appearance suggests he might be a Mormon, which is a plus, as Mormons are people who are raised to be helpful.
"What can I do for you, gentlemen?"
"We need to speak with the manager," Dubose says.
"Well, now, that would be me. Oren Luckman, what can I do for you?"
Jürgen says,
"IRS."
He looks at the other men, who are too interested in whatever little drama might play out here.
"We'd prefer to keep this discreet."
Oren Luckman's office is in a corner of the warehouse space. Piles of invoices cover the desk, weighed down by a variety of colorful polished stones. Indicating a red stone with black veining, Dubose says,
"That's a nice specimen of rhodonite."
He points to another.
"And that's an exceptional cabochon of chrysocolla."
"You know stones?"
Luckman's face shines with the delight of a collector meeting someone who doesn't think his peculiar enthusiasm makes him a Class A dweeb.
"It's long been a hobby of mine," Dubose reveals.
"Oh. Now, that's a spectacular chunk of quartz-embedded rhodochrosite. A real beauty."
"That's from the Sweet Home Mine in Colorado," says Luckman, with an annoying note of pride.
This is the first Jürgen has ever heard of Dubose's hobby. Not to be outdone, he points to a stone.
"Magnificent turquoise."
Luckman and Dubose regard him with something like pity, and the manager says,
"That's stained howlite."
"People who don't know any better," Dubose says, "buy howlite jewelry and pay a turquoise price."
Putting an end to stone talk, he withdraws his ID wallet from an inner coat pocket and flashes his National Security Agency credentials. As Jürgen produces his ID as well, Luckman is confused.
"But you said Internal Revenue Service."
"For the benefit of your two assistants back there," Jürgen explains. "We don't want them talking about NSA agents to other employees on the sales floor right now."
"We've spotted two suspects that just came into your store," Dubose says. "If they are who we think, we'll have to arrest them."
"Oh my," says Luckman.
"Nothing like this ever happens here."
Jürgen points to a large wall-mounted monitor on which is a view of what appears to be the area just inside the front door of the market.
"How many security cams can you show us?"
With almost as much pride as when reacting to Dubose's admiring words about the quartz-embedded whatever, Luckman says,
"One at a time or four in quad-screen format."
"And how many cameras altogether?"
"8."
"Just 8?
Jürgen asks.
"2 exterior, 6 in the store."
"Just 6,
Dubose laments.
"Should be at least 24.
"Surely not for a place this size," Luckman says. "Not around these parts."
With Luckman using a remote, they need maybe 2 minutes to find the black couple. The manager is able to zoom in on them for a satisfying close-up. Standing directly in front of the monitor, Dubose and Jürgen study the faces, the attitudes, the the way the woman moves.
It's them,
Dubose declares, and Jurgen agrees. They can wait until the Washingtons are leaving the store and pushing a cart full of grocery bags, draw down on them outside. But these two will be cautious exiting, alert for anything amiss. Going through a door, the husband will have his hand under his coat, on his weapon. They will be somewhat more relaxed in the parking lot, on the way to their wheels. However, the parking lot is sizable, and there aren't many vehicles in it on this Sunday afternoon. The moment they see Jurgen and Dubose moving toward them, the Washingtons will read the situation right, and there could be a firefight. A firefight isn't a risk worth taking. Not when this situation allows Jurgen and Dubose the element of surprise. One stone fancier to another, Dubose tells Luckman what they need to do and what help they require from him. The manager pales, but although he surely would have been slower to concede assistance to Jurgen, he is taken with Dubose's folksy manner and agrees to the strategy. 35. When the Washingtons had their shopping cart fully laden and were nearly finished, one of its wheels developed a stutter and wanted to pull a different direction from the other three.
Let me wrestle with it, Gavin said.
No, we're almost done, Jessie said, patting her purse in the fold-down basket. Let's just finish it according to plan. Maybe 3 minutes later, when they reached the front of the store and were approaching the cashier stations, a man working on a display of Coke, Diet Coke, and Coke Zero noticed the mountain of groceries they were pushing. His shirt tag said his name was Oren and that he was a manager.
You folks best go to checkout 3. Eddie there, he's our fastest checker. He'll have you out the door in no time.
Eddie was a 30-something guy with blonde hair and blue eyes. He looked a little like a shorter Robert Redford from the days when Redford was doing movies like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. He had a smarmy smile that Gavin didn't like, the kind of smile a bigot wore when he was pretending to like black people. Gavin went ahead of the cart to unload it as Jessie pushed it into the checkout lane, and he sensed something besides Eddie's smile that was wrong with the man. His shirt. Eddie was wearing a market apron over a patterned short-sleeved sport shirt. Hadn't all the other employees been wearing white shirts? And the name tag. It said Eduardo, not Eddie. Eduardo suggested Hispanic. This guy was about as Hispanic as the Queen of England. Gavin felt his right hand, powered by intuition, wanting to go under his coat for the Springfield Armory pistol. He glanced back toward the manager and saw him fading away from the Coke display, around the corner, into an aisle, looking back with something like alarm. He glanced at Jessie, and her expression said, "What?" Taking a large bag of corn chips off the top of the stuff in the shopping cart, Gavin contrived to drop it on the floor.
Oops.
If this was it, there was only one way out. The people who arrested them would not be operating according to the law. They would be Arcadians, and there would be no future for him or for Jessie that didn't involve a control mechanism. Slavery. He stooped, ostensibly to pick up the bag of corn chips, though in fact to draw the .45 before Eddie saw him making the move. As he slid his hand under his coat and pulled the pistol, he looked at Jessie again and thought,
"Oh God, how much I love you."
Thought it so hard that he hoped she'd actually hear him telepathically. 36. Maybe 10 seconds before Washington and wife will be exactly where they are wanted. 10 seconds before Jurgen and Dubose would have pulled their peacemakers and shouted, "Police!" The man seems to block the cart from coming in farther, and he drops a bag of corn chips. Jurgen does not like the way the dude drops the corn chips. His pistol is on a shelf under the cash register. As he reaches for it, Washington is coming back up from his stoop, and shit, he's got a cannon in his hand. Just then, Dubose, who's been crouched behind the magazine rack, comes out into the open and doesn't bother to shout police, like it would matter even if he did, and just rushes forward, squeezing off two shots, one of which takes Washington in the head. In a death reflex, Washington fires a round that misses Jurgen but point-blanks the cash register, and even as the register responds with noises of electronic distress, the woman is so quick that she's drawn a small gun designed for concealed carry, and is emptying it not at Jurgen, who is much closer to her, but at Dubose, who is forced to drop and scramble. The expression on the bitch's face is the most frightening thing that Jurgen has ever seen. Such horror and hatred and fury and indomitable intent that she seems supernatural. Like some creature risen out of an infernal bottomless darkness to collect souls and tie them, wriggling, to her belt. His first shot takes her in the shoulder, staggers her, and his second shot knocks her down. Customers and market employees are screaming and running for the doors, and Dubose is shouting, "Police! Police! Police!" Just in case some witness has a license for concealed carry and, in an unfortunate misunderstanding of the situation, might open fire on the legitimate authorities. In the wake of the gunshots, all that noise echoes hollowly in Jurgen's ears, as though it's issuing out of a deep well. Jurgen opens a waist-high gate and exits cashier's station number 3, stepping into the lane for station 2. Staying low, pistol in a two-hand grip, heart knocking so hard that his vision pulses, he rounds the display of candy and gum and copies of the National Enquirer. There on the floor, behind the full shopping cart, is the woman, on her back, head turned toward him, still alive. She seems unable to get up, maybe paralyzed, but with her left hand she is reaching for the dropped pistol. He moves toward her and kicks the weapon out of her reach and looks down as blood bubbles on her lips. Her eyes are fierce, one brown and one a dazzling green, and if a stare could kill, he would be as dead as her husband. Jurgen's hearing remains temporarily impaired because of all the gunfire, and though the woman's voice must be weak, it comes to him with piercing clarity. "I'm not done with you," she says, and then she dies. Her eyes are fixed on Jurgen, as if she can still see him from some far shore. At first, he backs away from her corpse, but then, in spite of all the evidence to the contrary, he suddenly wonders if they have made a mistake, if perhaps these aren't the Washingtons after all, but some innocent couple of similar appearance and with a legitimate reason to be armed. This is a big mess, any way you look at it. But if they aren't the Washingtons, it's an even bigger mess. A career-ending mess. As agents of the revolution, a failure this epic will not earn them early retirement. The only way careers like theirs are ended is two bullets in the back of the head, or nano-web enslavement. He goes to the corpse and squats beside it, and, after a brief hesitation, pulls up one leg of the khakis, revealing the Ottobock. Relief floods through him as he looks into her dead eyes and says, "Try to run a 10K now, bitch." Part 5. Lost Boys. 1. The frozen sky lay invisible behind the numberless flakes that scaled from it and crystalled the air in their silent white descent. By 2 o'clock, they had traveled U.S. Highway 50 west and then south. They exited onto a county road, and from there made their way to an unpaved track that, according to Booth Hendrickson, had been carved out and was maintained by the Forest Service. The single lane, with periodic lay-bys, had been plowed during the current storm, though probably not during the past hour. With four-wheel drive and tire chains, Jane felt confident that she could navigate it. The fabled lake lay to the west, a quarter mile from this rough track, and still far below, screened from sight as much by forest as by the quiet storm. Lodgepole pine, red fir, white pine, juniper and mountain hemlock received the snow. In spite of the urgency of this mission, there was a timeless quality to the scene and a sense that all the works of humanity and all the dramas of Jane's life were but a dream from which she had awakened into this. Booth had been her captive for well over 24 hours. The longer he remained missing, the more effort would be expended in the search for him, and the wider the net the Arcadians would cast. Those in charge of the search didn't know about the crooked staircase, about what a profound impact it had had on his life, and what thing of great value waited for Jane at the bottom of that fearsome descent. Other than Booth and the couple who maintained the estate in the absence of its owner, only his mother, Annabel, and brother were aware that the vertical passage existed. Simon hadn't been admitted to the Arcadian conspiracy. He knew nothing of the brain implants, and Annabel might not credit the possibility that her elder son would speak about this place where his abject humiliation and formation occurred, unless she knew that Jane possessed ampules of the control mechanism and might have injected Mama's best boy. Booth hadn't known of the ampules, however, so perhaps no one else knew either. And if the most elite of the conspirators did know, it was only Annabel who also knew about the crooked staircase. Only Annabel who might in time realize why Jane would go there if she learned of it. A second track branched off the first, likewise white-mantled but plowed recently enough that it was passable, and she switched to it at Booth's direction. The way grew steeper. The trees crowded closer. She was just minutes from her destination. For centuries, for thousands of years, the lake, as well as the forest and alpine meadows surrounding it, had enchanted those who journeyed there. For some, the effect was greater than enchantment. This place had a mystical aura, and evoked a feeling that the truth and meaning of the world lay behind fewer veils here than elsewhere. Only the Great Lakes were larger than Tahoe, but Tahoe was far deeper, shaped by glaciers 1,000,000 years ago and plunging 1,645 feet at its deepest. The clarity of the water provided visibility to surprising depth, and the coloration under a summer sun transformed it into a vast display of emeralds and sapphires. The lake never froze, but its cold temperatures greatly slowed decomposition at extreme depth. 17 years after he drowned, a diver was found 300 feet below the surface, his body all but perfectly preserved.
"Stop here," Booth said, and pointed.
She pulled into a lay-by and put the explorer in park.
"We walk from here," he said.
She wished they had stopped somewhere to buy insulated jackets and boots. However, the forecast had called for only a fraction as much snow as had fallen, and outfitting herself and this man in his condition had seemed a daunting task fraught with risk. As if privy to her thoughts, he said,
"It's a short walk."
2. The San Diego County Sheriff's Department maintains a major substation in Borrego Springs, which means deputies are on scene at the market almost before the last echoes of the gunfire fade away. They are well-trained, professional, efficient, and a pain in the ass, as far as Carter Jurgen is concerned. He and DuBose are NSA agents, among other things, and these guys are nothing but generic fuzz, plain vanilla cops. Nevertheless, they want to have a role in the investigation of the shootings because this is their turf, their town, these are their neighbors. There is no damn role for them. This is ostensibly a national security matter, far above their pay grade. None of them possesses the necessary security clearance to work the investigation. Not one of their precious neighbors has so much as suffered a paper cut in the course of the event. The only significant damage to property is the bullet-drilled cash register. Otherwise, losses involve only a small quantity of candy bars, gum, and tabloid newspapers spattered with blood and brain tissue. No big deal. Yet here they are, frustrating Jurgen and DuBose, taking photos of the so-called crime scene and busily collecting the names of those witnesses who haven't fled.
DuBose puts in a call for backup. There will be other agents on scene as soon as they can be choppered in. Greater numbers will help push the hometown boys out of the picture. But then the watch captain from the substation shows up, a guy named Foursquare, if it can be believed. He has a bulldog jaw and the steely eyes of a Vegas pit boss who would call his own mother a cheat and throw her out of the game if she won more than $40 at blackjack. He wants to know who the decedents are, and he's not satisfied to be told only that they are foreign agents. He wants to check their ID, but Jurgen heatedly argues against disturbing the cadavers, even though there's no ID to find. He and DuBose had the foresight to take the wallets from the bodies of Washington and his wife before the local gendarmes arrived. They have also found a key to a Honda in one of the dead man's sport coat pockets. While Jurgen debates jurisdiction with Foursquare, DuBose goes into the parking lot, supposedly to make a list of the vehicles that might belong to the debtors and to record the license plate numbers, but in fact, to try Washington's car key in each of the Hondas. No sooner does Foursquare stop grumbling about needing to know who the decedents are than he takes aside Oren Luckman, the store manager, and is recording a statement from him. One of the deputies is searching for expended shell casings, and another escorts a tall, somber civilian to Jurgen and introduces him as a town mortician who also serves as the coroner. DuBose returns and takes Jurgen aside to inform him that the key fits the green sedan. The car contains a trunk full of groceries in bags from the town's other major market. Evidently they were stocking up for several weeks of hibernation. There is nothing else in the Honda to identify its owner, no registration paper and no insurance company card in the glove box, as there should be. While Captain Foursquare records Luckman's fevered reimagining of the shootout, DuBose goes to the manager's office. He intends to use the market's computer to backdoor the California DMV and run the Honda's license plate to find the registered owner. Jurgen is left with the swarm of uniformed busybodies. If there's one thing he despises the most about local cops, no matter what locale they hail from, it's that too damn many of them think they have a sacred duty to enforce the law, as though the law isn't just what a bunch of money-grubbing, power-crazed politicians cobble together, as if instead it's handed down by God on stone tablets. And here in Borrego Springs, he seems to be dealing with a nest of their kind. He counsels himself to be patient with these sworn to serve and protect types. All will be well. If DuBose can identify to whom the Honda is registered, they will most likely have the address at which the Washingtons took shelter. That's where the boy will be. 3. The tightly gathered trees took most of the snowfall upon their boughs, admitting but a fraction to the ground between them. No wind had yet arisen. Snow sought the earth in silence, mounding for the most part beneath the barren limbs of the deciduous hardwoods. The undergrowth was sparse. Carrying her leather tote bag, Jane had no trouble following Hendrickson, although the day was cold enough to make her eyes water. Her breath plumed from her. How he knew, she couldn't tell, for the woods seemed too uniform to provide easily recognizable landmarks, but he glanced over his shoulder to say, "We've just stepped onto the estate. Not much farther now." Annabel owned 9 acres here, wrested from Booth's father in their divorce settlement. Only the lower 3 acres on which the house was situated were walled, the upper 6 left for some future purpose. The stairhead building stood under pines, the lower limbs of which had been cut off to accommodate the structure, and therefore it was canopied by higher growth. Windowless, crafted from native stone, perhaps 12 feet in diameter, the structure had a domed roof of the same stone, so that it suggested an oversized, ancient kiln. The steel door stood in a steel frame. She put down the tote and examined the Schlage deadbolt. The cylinder was rimless, preventing anyone from pulling it out of the escutcheon.
The two spanner screws that fixed the escutcheon to the door had been soldered so they could not be removed. If anyone had been curious enough to want to break into the building, they would have required a couple hours and would have made so much noise that even the caretakers of the house, 500 feet below, would have been aware of the effort. As Jane took the lock release gun from the tote, Hendrickson let out a thin sound of distress and turned from the building and stood trembling more violently than could be accounted to the cold. "You can do this," she told him. Then, remembering the power she had over him, she said, "You will do this." He harked back to his childhood, as he had done before, his brow furrowing and his eyes narrowing and his voice turning hard. The rant came from him in a rush.
"Finding your way with a light is nothing, boy. But when you can go through it, top to bottom in the bitter dark, as blind as some dung beetle living on bat shit in a cavern, then you'll be something. These stairs are life, boy, the truth of this life, of this dark world, the truth of humanity in all its cruelty and viciousness. If you want to survive, you pathetic little shit, you better learn to be strong like me. Go down the hole and learn, boy. Down the hole."
His recital of his mother's tirade ended with a shudder and a series of frantic gasps for breath, as if he were drowning, though great exhalations smoked from him. The storm-faded light grew dimmer at just that moment, the winter sun more an idea than a reality. The tree-roofed clearing seemed to be a borderland between the material world and a realm of spirits. A breeze arose at last and swept some snow off the boughs overhead, and shapen clouds of flakes moved through the clearing like half-formed figures of people lost and seeking.
"Don't make me go down in the dark," Hendrickson pleaded.
From the tote, Jane retrieved a flashlight and gave it to him. She had one for herself. "We won't be in the dark. We'll have our lights. You'll show me the way. You will show me the way. You understand, Booth?"
"Yes."
"You'll be all right."
"I will. I know I will,"
he agreed, though he didn't sound convinced. If his mother was a twisted work, his father must have been one too, in his own way. After all, it was the father who had found the crooked staircase. Instead of reporting it to the state or to university archaeologists and anthropologists who would have thought it a treasure beyond valuation, he had kept it to himself as an amusement, a rare curiosity. He had used his longtime employees to construct this stairhead building. Jane lightly kicked the wall to knock the snow from her shoes. They were wet all the way through, and her feet were cold. She opened the door with the lock release gun, reached inside, flipped a switch. Light bloomed in the round stone room. She ushered Hendrickson ahead of her and crossed the threshold after him. The lock was a deadbolt that could only be engaged with a key, but before she let the door close behind her, she confirmed that a keyway existed on the inner face of the escutcheon. In case someone should lock the door from the outside, she would still be able to use the lock release gun to get out of the building. Directly ahead, the floor shelved away through a hole that Booth regarded with dread. She went to it and directed the beam of her flashlight into it and saw steep stairs, perhaps of limestone, that had been shaped out of the natural rock flue with primitive tools. The way was narrow, the ceiling low ahead, and the walls of nature's making were mostly worn smooth by millennia of water's patient labor. "You won't be afraid," she told Hendrickson. "You will show me the way, and you won't be afraid." Although breath still paled from between his parted lips, he looked as dead as the man on the mortuary table in the basement of Gilberto's funeral home. After a hesitation, he switched on his flashlight and took the lead into the crooked staircase. 4. two cooling deaders on the market floor, a container of melting ice cream dripping through the contents of the shopping cart, blood here, brains there, Oren Luckman fluttering anxiously just beyond the scene of the shootings, the ugly light of overhead fluorescent tubes, the tedium. The situation with Captain Foursquare and his contingent of diligent deputies becomes so untenable that Carter Jurgen uses his smartphone to call an Arcadian who is deputy director of the NSA. The man is also a former United States senator who, as an elected official, always managed to wheedle an abundance of FaceTime on TV. He has styled himself as a champion of public employee unions, so there is little doubt that Foursquare will know his name. The senator's voice is distinct and easily recognized, and when Jurgen hands the phone to Foursquare, the captain is impressed, then charmed, then won over by whatever the great man tells him. Their conversation lasts at most 4 minutes, but Foursquare is smiling when he returns the phone to Jurgen.
"You should have told me you work under him," the captain chides Jurgen.
"Well, sir, I always feel it's wrong to drop his name unless I have to. I don't think I've done enough for the country to trade on the accomplishments of a man like him."
"That speaks well for you," says Foursquare. "We can't stand down entirely, but we'll stand aside until your incoming contingent gets here. And we all agree there's nothing more we can do. He says they're airborne and sure to be here in half an hour."
"Thank you, Captain. I'm most grateful," Jurgen says, with as much fake sincerity as he can muster. In fact, he's no more grateful than he would be to a disease-bearing mosquito that keeps trying to take a bite of him. And here comes DuBose, looking not like a man who has solved a mystery, but like a man who needs to take a leak and is on a quest to find the ideal person on whom to empty his bladder. 5. Decades after his cruel formation, Hendrickson going down the hole again, Jane following him, but not so close that he might turn and strike her in a moment of unlikely rebellion. The descending passage seemed to construct itself only as the beams of light flowed across it, as though such eerie architecture must be a work of the imagination, dreamed into being. Smooth, pale walls of stone sloped down in velvety folds shaped by unknowable millennia of moving water, no doubt including the melting of the miles-thick sheet formed during at least one ice age. Millions of years earlier, long before a human being walked the earth, nature had begun to form the crooked staircase, perhaps when violent vertical faulting formed the Sierra Nevada Mountains on the west and the Carson Range on the east, leaving the Tahoe Basin between. The staircase was actually a series of small caverns, each partly atop the one below it, the entire formation of galleries angling down toward the lake, through more than 500 feet of mountain, like a chambered hive. There were also narrow corridors of stone snaking off to other rooms that weren't among those vertically aligned. According to Hendrickson, some of those passages looped like entrails and returned to the main descent, creating a maze. Others were dead ends, some 100 feet long, some continuing for half a mile or farther, before dwindling to such a restricted width that not even a child could crawl farther through them. Jane's tote bag was slung from her left shoulder, and in her left hand she held a can of spray paint that Gilberto had given her. At each bewildering junction of stone passages, she marked the way back to the stairhead with an arrow. Although the world itself, in its eternal remaking, had done the basic work through millions of years, human beings had taken nature's random art and carved it to a purpose. Where the floor sloped at a negotiable angle, it was left natural, but when it became precarious, especially when any steepness led to a fissure into which someone might fall, crude steps had been shaped in the stone. Each crevasse, as narrow as 2 feet, as wide as 7, was bridged by a plank seated in notches cut into the lips of the fissures. When Booth's father discovered the staircase, the bridge planks had long before rotted and fallen into the clefts they once spanned. The secondary passages had also been stepped and bridged where necessary, some climbing and some trending down into perpetual night. Early in the descent, they arrived at a larger chamber before which Hendrickson halted. He bent forward, clutching his stomach as though plagued by abdominal pain. But he didn't look back at Jane or plead to retreat. After a minute, rising to full height again, he continued into a room in which a fault line bisected the ceiling, matched by a parallel fault in the floor. The medieval atmosphere weighed on the heart, and the air carried the faint fungal smell of things that thrived only in the dark. The right half of the chamber was a foot higher than the left. Although the right portion lay dry and pale, the ceiling to the left bared a row of huge teeth, like the staves of a castle portcullis that might drop to bar entry, from which brown water dripped onto a mud floor. The stone was wet, dark, glistening as if lacquered. On both sides of the room, on every ledge and on the floor, were severed hands gone to bone in centuries past. Hundreds of fleshless hands seemed to twitch in the sweeping beams of light, skeletal fingers extended as though in supplication or clutched as if in rage. Those in the dry space were mostly white and well-preserved, but those in the moist area were more yellow than not, mottled brown, sometimes serving as matrices on which mold grew like rodent hair. Jane was prepared to find this, and worse, on their journey, because Hendrickson had spoken of it. But the tableau was a grislier spectacle than expected. She didn't know what to make of it, except that this was no sacred catacomb where peaceful people placed the dead with reverence. To her, trained in homicide investigation, these appeared to be trophies. The wrist bones were crushed and splintered where hands had been hacked from arms, perhaps sometimes from the arms of the living. The cavern told a story of violence and brutality, of ancient war and subjugation. Carved in the walls were strange runes, each sharp character like a cry of hatred.
"See this, you little coward! Look!" Hendrickson whispered. "If a man intends you harm, cut off his hands before he can act."
Whoever had shaped the steps and adapted the cavern to their purpose must have been those who murdered these hundreds and made the crooked staircase into an ossuary. Evidence existed of Paleo-Indian tribes living in this area more than 14,000 years ago, but little was known of them, other than they were hunters of large game, including mastodons. Their tools were thought to have been such as flint or obsidian spearheads and hammerstones, primitive and insufficient for the stone shaping done here. Their cultures were said to be largely peaceable, but in fact, so little had they left behind that they were ghosts in the fog of ancient history. Only carbon dating and other tests would help to determine who created this place and furnished it with bones. Perhaps some paleo culture had possessed more advanced tools than were thought. Or, as Hendrickson suggested when she questioned him at Gilberto's place, it was known that thousands of years nearer our time, the northern Paiute had brutally oppressed the Washoe Indians. Perhaps an even more militant faction of Paiutes had done part of this. The Martis Indians had also lived in this general area for 2,500 years before disappearing without a trace around 500 BC, which happened to be about the same time that other tribes invented the bow and arrow. These caverns might hold the remains of the long-vanished Martis people. Hendrickson channeled his mother, and his words were like the susurrus of centipedes crawling the walls.
"See, boy. See this? Did they eat these people after slaughtering them? We're not far from Donner Pass, where stranded pioneers ate their dead to survive. Dog eat dog, so they say. More true is man eat man.
Jane thought of Hendrickson, 5 years and younger, sleeping in a locked boy-size box, coffined in darkness as punishment, and by the age of 6, sent into this maze alone. At the top, as they had entered this time, told that he would be let out only at the bottom. The first few times he'd been given a flashlight, but on occasions beyond his counting, he'd been denied a light, and had felt his way through damp stone corridors, down disconnected sets of zigzagging stairs, across fissure-bridging planks, through crypts appointed with trophies of genocide, like a lost spirit haunting the haunted dark, hearing noises he didn't make, and wondering at their origin, feeling presences where none should be, with no food, with nothing to drink but the cold water that formed shallow pools in certain chambers, and sometimes tasted like iron, sometimes like nothing he wanted to name. On the worst occasions, lost for 2 or 3 days. As pitiable as he was, he nevertheless deserved some admiration for having endured without being driven entirely insane. But if he had remained functional, he had nonetheless been mentally deformed, twisted, and knotted into a creature that, though pitiable, had no slightest measure of pity for others. During his many ordeals in darkness, he at some point ceased to be just a boy and became a boy who was a monster. The minotaur of this labyrinth. He didn't eat human flesh as did the minotaur of Crete, but other people had no value for him except to be used in whatever way the use of them might satisfy him. For all her pity, Jane kept in mind, cavern by cavern, step by step, that what she had here on a leash was a monster who passed for human. In the long history of monsters, they sooner or later slipped their leashes. 6. Some of the sheriff's deputies have returned to their regular patrols. Foursquare and 2 of his men are standing together in the produce department, admiring the fruit, waiting to see if they might be needed, which they won't be, when the additional NSA contingent arrives. Upon his return from the manager's office, Dubose draws Jurgen aside to the relative privacy of pallets stacked with large bags of charcoal being offered at a special price now that the barbecuing season is about to start in earnest.
This damn well better not be another freaking banana peel we have to take a fall on before we can get our hands on that little bastard. The plates on that Honda expired 4 years ago, and the registration was never renewed. It shouldn't be on the road.
You've got the name and address of who last registered it?
Some guy named Fennel Martin.
What kind of name is Fennel?
Hell if I know. But he's still in the local phone book at the same address that's on the registration.
The rhythmic sound of a rotary wing draws their attention to the window. As the glass begins to hum with vibrations, they step outside into the parking lot and use their hands as visors and look to the west, where the helicopter angles down out of the sun. 7. Jane used the spray paint so often that she worried the can might be empty before they reached the house at the bottom of the serried caverns, leaving critical final turns unmarked. She formed smaller arrows on the walls. Most of the chambers through which they passed were marked with runes, but only a few of the larger ones contained bones. The least disturbing was nevertheless a dramatic display in a space decorated instead with pictographs that were perhaps far older than the runes. The contents also might have been older, suggesting that more than one ancient culture had used this place to memorialize their skill as hunters of both animals and humans. The skulls of 3 mastodons were elevated above Jane on pedestals of stacked stone, immense and chalk-white in the probing lights, shadows shifting in the sockets as if eyes of some immaterial nature still looked out from the empty craniums and across thousands of years of time. The enormous tusks, clearly having been broken out of the skulls in order to get them through the narrower passages, had somehow been reattached, curving in majestic threat. In two successive chambers, hundreds of human skulls were arranged on ledges, like some collection of grotesque beer steins, most bearing evidence of ritualistic murder in the form of pikes made of chert or obsidian, one in each forehead, bristling like a horn, perhaps pounded into the skull with a crude hammerstone. Those not featuring